How do you gather the bigger picture on climate change? Associate Professor Peter Ralph is Executive Director of the Climate Change Cluster at UTS, a new research initiative looking at how biological models can improve climate change prediction. He gets the big picture of climate change by ranging over eddy covariance and global warming modelling, micrometeorology, coral bleaching and seagrasses that detect pollution, and the ecology of the Antarctic. So you're looking at something called eddy covariance in your global modelling.
Yes, eddy covariance is a very powerful tool at looking at very small changes in wind direction and the carbon dioxide, and we're also now applying it to underwater applications. So when a air parcel or a parcel of water moves, it has a direction, and we're measuring the amount of gases that are in those parcels of air and water, and the net sum of carbon dioxide going up or down will define whether or not that habitat that you're measuring has put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere or taken it out of the atmosphere.
So that these parcels of air that are sort of a little bit separated from the surrounding air, and my understanding is that the hemispheres don't always mix everything as well.
Oh yeah, at that scale. We're working at a much smaller scale. We're working at the scale of a large forest or a river or an estuary. So our measurements are very, very fast and very, very small scale. They're called micrometeorological changes. They're not the macro meteorological changes.
So what do you measure them with?
We measure them with what's called an acoustic coupled velocimeter. So it's a device that measures the movement of mass in front of it in three dimensions. And then we sample the carbon dioxide or the oxygen at a very high speed, up to 25 times a second. We have to do velocity measurements, direction measurements, and gas measurements.
So you're actually looking at the composition of the air to find out how much carbon dioxide and how much of other things are in the air.
Yes.
And you're also working in Antarctica?
Yes. Well, the whole of the research facility that we have in the Department of Environmental Sciences, there's a number of us working in climate change. And the aspects of climate change range from the tropical reefs looking at coral bleaching all the way through to the polar regions looking at the impact of climate change on Antarctic sea ice. Antarctic sea ice is critical to the survival of the Southern Ocean ecosystems. The ice, which there's 20 million square kilometres each year, has algae that grows on the bottom of it. That algae supports the entire ecosystem down there. As climate change causes less production of ice and changes the temperature and the amount of light going through the ice, we're getting changes in the amount of algae, which then knocks on to the krill. The krill are fed that support the penguins and the seals and the whales. So you change the ice, you change the whole ecosystem. And that's what we're looking at.
And so in the tropical end, you've got the corals. And so when the corals get too hot, they lose all the things that make them colourful.
Yes, yes, they bleach. When you get an increase in temperature of about 1 degree, a coral is a symbiosis of an animal and a plant. So you have a tiny algal cell encased in an animal cell. And when the symbiosis is happy, you have light coming into the algae, it photosynthesizes and gives sugar to the animal. If the temperature is too high, the photosynthesis is altered, and what we're finding is that the algae is expelled. But a lot of work that we've been doing for the last 10 years is now showing that the biochemistry of why the photosystems break down is quite a complex and not immediately apparent explanation. You can't just look at higher plants or other microalgae and say, well, you increase temperature, those photosynthesis processes seem to survive very well. But when they're in an animal and you increase it by 1 degree, it's the interaction between the animal and the plant that breaks down. It's not necessarily the photosynthesis itself, because it's quite a robust biochemical process.
Right, so maybe it's some sort of communications.
Yes, yes, signalling. The way that the animal exchanges nutrients and allows gases to move in and out of the plant is more than likely part of the reason. And we're looking at whether or not genetic causes or genetic traits are linked to these bleaching responses, whether or not it's the thickness of the animal tissue, the pigments in the animal tissue. There's a whole range of things that the animal does to make the algae live in a very comfortable environment. And when that breaks down, the whole of the symbiosis breaks down and the coral bleaches, and that's when it loses its algae. It's got about a month before it will starve if it doesn't have algae in its tissues. So it's got a very short window that it needs to regrow its algae or get lots of plankton in the water and feed on that. We've recently done some very interesting work where we fed the corals quite a lot of brine shrimp, little sea monkeys.
Yes.
We fed them with those and the corals didn't bleach. So if you feed the coral well and keep it very healthy, the photosynthesis is not affected. Whereas when you have them with less algae to eat or zooplankton to eat, they rely on the internal algae to provide all the sugars, and that's not enough. So we're quite excited to find out more about this and get this published quite soon.
So it looks like there's not really enough species of little animals for it to feed on.
The thing is, it's interesting, coral reefs are marine deserts. That's why they grow where they grow. There's very little food in the water, and the reason why a coral survives so well is because it recycles all the food. It's a very, very tightly controlled exchange between animals and plants, even between fish on the reef. They eat the corals, they eat some of the algae, but their waste is recycled within the reef. So you don't see a lot of nutrients leaving the reef. And so it's really important to keep all of the nutrients there. And if the corals are well fed, then they seem to be able to survive bleaching better than if they're not well fed.
So maybe there's something we could do to help the corals.
We hope that people don't make that assumption, because we don't want people going out and enriching the oceans to put lots more food for the phytoplankton, which makes more food for the zooplankton, which by our results would mean that the corals would do better. We don't think that would be a good outcome, because all we'd create would be a pea green soup and the reef would die. So we have to keep a very, very delicate balance in the amount of food and how it's recycled. The best solution we should do is to reduce our carbon emissions and reduce the elevated temperature of the ocean. That would be a much better outcome than trying to continue polluting with carbon and trying to put a band-aid on the system by giving the coral more food to eat. So definitely the best outcome would be a reduction in carbon from my perspective.
As well as all the carbon dioxide pollution causing all the global warming, you're also able to look at other forms of pollution.
Yes, yes. The lab works in all areas of marine plants, and marine plants, because they generally grow in shallow water, people like to live near shallow water areas. They have their boats and we transport a lot of resources in shallow water areas. We happen to have lots of oil spills and we pollute the coastal area with heavy metals. Herbicides, we spray herbicides on all of our gardens. When it rains, the herbicides don't just stay in our gardens, they go into the estuaries and the creeks and they wash in and they ultimately kill the seagrasses, the macroalgae, the mangroves. So we've been working on understanding what amount of contaminant or pollution these systems can tolerate. We're doing some work at the moment with oil pollution. When there's an oil spill, you have to make a decision very, very quickly. Are we going to let the oil, because the oil floats, when there's waves and current, it's going to wash the oil onto the edge of the estuary, the intertidal area. Now the decision is, do you spray chemicals on that oil that causes the oil to break up and sink? That stops it going into the mangroves, onto the rocky platforms, killing all of the mussels, the oysters, the crabs. That's a good decision, but if you spray the dispersants on the oil and the oil sinks, most times what's underneath is the seagrasses. Now, the seagrasses is where all of the juvenile fish that are the nurseries for all of our coastal fisheries. So if you kill your seagrasses with an oil spill, you're going to have impacts on your coastal fisheries. So it's a very, very important decision to make. Do you stop the oil going ashore, or do you just let it disperse itself naturally? And our research is giving managers a better idea on how to make that decision. How much risk, how much can a seagrass meadow take? How much oil can we allow to go in there? And oil is a natural byproduct and it does degrade pretty quickly. So I think we're going to be able to help a lot of the decision makers make the right decision so that we can protect the greatest amount of the habitats in the estuaries. There's a lot of very, very interesting research going on at UTS, and I think the recent investment by the university in climate change research is going to yield some phenomenally interesting and important outcomes. We're going to be employing and bringing to UTS some of the world leaders in understanding these climate change models and the biological complexity. So it's going to be a very interesting space to watch, and I think over the next 6 months to a year, we will have some phenomenal stories to tell the world about. So I think the take-home message is keep an eye on us. We'll be back to tell more stories very, very soon.
Peter Ralph, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Associate Professor Peter Ralph, Executive Director of the Climate Change Cluster.